Who was not here last week? Raise your hands, please. Did you have a chance to listen to the recording? Okay, so I'm going to kind of recap a little bit to get us onto this first skanda. that'll help anyway, because this is, you know, potentially challenging material. I mean, it is challenging material. I'll just be straightforward. No beating around the bush here. I think now one of the things I'd like to ask people to do, if you haven't or haven't followed us or coming in more recently, we started this course of study about a year and a half ago, was it?
February
2014, we started to teach.
So in the process of that, we studied the Four Noble Truths, and we basically, just to understand what we're doing here, Buddhism is about freeing us from our own confusion, and it's about fundamentally enlightenment, and enlightenment has to do with knowing our mind. So knowing our mind means knowing what is the problem. And the problem is all over the place, in case we haven't noticed. But briefly, the way the Buddha put it is that fundamentally the problem is suffering. And so if you would like to review the course on suffering, there is an outline there where you can it breaks it down in terms of the components and how it works. But just to make it very, very brief.
And that is from September, a year ago,
okay.
Actually.
So that basically we're looking at anxiety and fundamental bewilderment. And this bewilderment anxiety is what sets the whole thing off. So the Buddha proposed that there was suffering, there was a cause of it, and there was a possible way out or a way to deal with it, a liberation from suffering, and that way is the path. So that's what we're doing here. What we're doing here when we look at the Abhidharma, and let me just recapitulate. Does anybody remember or would like to? Does anybody remember talking about it this last week, what the Abhidharma was introduced as being? Okay, so in the very first parts of Buddhism, early Buddhism, it was divided into what we call three baskets, the Tripitaka. And there are three aspects to it. One is the Vinaya. Vinaya is about precepts. It's about conduct. It's about how to behave, order our lives, take responsibility for ourselves and our actions. Second one is sutra, and that has to do with our meditation practice, which gives us stability and insight into the nature of who we are and what we're doing and the nature, ultimately, of everything else. The third basket is the Abhidharma, which gives us the psychological background and the capacity to understand how to communicate our insights, both to ourselves in terms of a larger frame of reference, and to communicate that with others. Does that ring a bell? Does anybody have any questions from that last week in terms of? Okay, good. Yes?
The Abhidharma is basically communication.
Sorry?
Abhidharma is communication.
It's about communication, because with that understanding and the capacity to grasp the larger context in which things arise, dwell, and cease, in other words, our experience, we actually can make it intelligible and communicate that to others. So, you know, Buddhism is ultimately very practical. It's super pragmatic. And it only has to do with here and now. So, in other words, even though when we talk about this so-called Mr. or Mrs. Ego, which we might also call Mr. Vanity and Mrs. Self-Love, or you can switch the genders.
Self-loathing or any of
them. All of that. It's just all of the various costumes it wears. You know, it likes to talk about having a history and, you know, the beginnings and the middle, and maybe there's an end and maybe there's just not an end, but a reinvention, as Michael brought up last week, of continuous reinvention. which is the basic process of how ego seems to think it can master experience by reinventing itself. So, but the thing to understand is that one thing ego abhors and can't deal with is just fundamentally here and now. And so when we talk about this process of the development of ego, we're talking about something that's continuously happening moment by moment, second by second. And so, how the early teachings and understanding the nature of ego could be understood in a very straightforward and simple way was by describing five basic functions or aspects that constitute sentient beings. Do we understand what a sentient being is? Any questions about that?
What is a sentient being?
Yes.
What is it?
What is it?
Yeah.
Would anybody like
capable
to?
Capable of thought.
Maybe. But a sentient being basically is an entity or a being who basically identifies itself through its sentient experience. Okay?
Sentient means what?
Feeling or sensory. It has some kind of sense. It has some kind of experience of, and we'll go into that, but that experience could be different for different beings. I mean, I'm not sure if an amoeba necessarily feels the same way as a more complex individual. But we're going to start with the human realm because this is the one we know about and we can actually relate to. So these functions were called skandhas. And skandha is spelled a couple of different ways, skanda or skandha. It's the same thing. And they are known as aggregates or bundles or a pile or a heap. And there are five of them. These five consist of what are named form, feeling, perception, concept. Concept can also be called mental formations, and consciousness. So, now, we have... the one thing we're reading, this is our main text we're reading for the Abhidharma, and I have to warn you, this is not particularly the traditional, at least the traditional Theravadan way of describing the skandhas. It is actually coming from, you could say, a much more accelerated or advanced perspective. And I'll have to basically clarify this. The main distinction is going to be in the first skandha, and this is the critical one. So, and then we're going to talk about the first skandha tonight. The first skandha is the most important one in terms of how, because all the other skandhas come out and build on top of it. It's not a slow process, it's rather instantaneous, but it requires that first skandha to give rise to all the other skandhas. I think it's really important that you understand the more traditional understanding of form so that when we refer to the form in this text, we will understand that if you try to talk to somebody else who has to be a Buddhist and they're saying, what are you talking about? You'll know that this is coming from a particular perspective, which is, as I say, more advanced than the traditional perspective of describing form. Form is usually just the fundamental experience of form itself, as we would call sensory form. And that means color, shape, size, texture. It's more in the general sense of form. And so form is basically this point that starts to set off some kind of disturbance. And the reason why is because it's constantly changing. It's constantly changing. And so...
Which is constantly changing? The form or form?
The form. The form. And so the issue is, the capacity for the mind to maintain a sense of continuity, which it decides it needs for security purposes, is basically where all the trouble begins. Now, in the way we encounter the form here, the first skanda talks about something called the primordial ground. And actually, this is a very important topic. And when we will come back to again and again throughout our course of study of Dharma. Because the ground is the basis for everything. It's the basis for all arising. And this ground, we've talked about it, we've touched on it from an angle in our previous studies of emptiness, where we introduced emptiness. Now, if anyone here hasn't encountered that term, we should consult with us later, and we'll go into that and share with that, and also refer you to some points on the website where you can find a discussion of that. Yes?
I want to be clear. This is the newer understanding of form as the primordial
ground.
Right. That's the different
understanding.
Yes. But it's not new to our teaching. We introduced it as rest in the nature of alaya, remember?
Right,
but it's
new compared to the traditional.
The Theravada.
It's not part of Theravada teachings, but it's part of our teachings.
They don't acknowledge the form. Okay. Now, what's going to happen reading this text is you'll find that the Theravadins say there are six consciousnesses. So this is just a contrast with what you're going to read in this book. And we say there are eight. So now, we don't exclude anything that the Theravadins say. They actually focus on eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and then a mind that basically is organized, capable of organizing those sensory experiences into some kind of intelligibility. So that's exactly the same, but then we have an additional two consciousnesses. And those consciousness, we're not going to go into detail about this right now, we're just introducing the general view. Seventh consciousness, which is kind of an editor, and it's editing something in the eighth consciousness. We introduced alaya before. We introduced alaya in a general sense when we were studying the slogans.
Lojong
slogans, rest in the nature of alaya. But you know, when they came up with that teaching, they did not make the distinction between the alaya, the two alayas. Okay. So get your pencils out and keep track of this. So there's the alaya, which is the eighth consciousness, which is basically the stuff we carry around in our unconscious. It's our baggage. Okay, it's all the basic potentials. And actually, we'll go into more of that as we go into the fourth skanda, which basically discusses these various aspects of mind and of thought, the construction of thought and mind, positive, negative, and neutral. They're all there. In this case, however, that teaching which we talked about, and we did bring it up just briefly, was that there's another deeper alaya. And that's kind of the foundation of everything. You know, just where everything is coming from. It's great space. It's inconceivable. So, like emptiness, it's beyond the mind's capacity to grasp. And yet, at the same time, as we progress on our path and explore meditation, as we begin to learn how to work with the understanding of emptiness, and that we will discover that we can actually, it's not so... just, it's not just a blank, it's not at all. It's quite rich, it's vivid, it's intelligent, it's all the intelligence. So this is something we will experience and encounter as we go further along. Yes, yes.
What's the difference between emptiness and primordial ground?
Not a lot. You could say that primordial ground is empty, but emptiness also is luminous. In other words, it isn't just empty, meaning it's empty in this case. It doesn't mean a vacuum, as we discussed before, but it actually is simply something more beyond the grasp of our conceptual mind. And at the same time, it's the most intimate aspect of our experience. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with basically just fundamental nowness. So nowness, just to recover that for a moment, is really important, because when we talk about the skandhas and we talk about the development of ego, we are talking about everything happening in on top of nowness, that the ground is this nowness itself. Mm-hmm. It's so simple, too simple for us to take in. Too simple. We think it has to be much more complicated, and we're going to build on it. We're going to make something out of it. We're going to, you know, put wheels on it. We're going to take off. We are not going to simply stay here with what this is, which is so inconceivable, and yet it's also the most intimate and most, you could say, in some sense, real dimension of ourselves.
And that's where all our ego thoughts originate from?
Well, they don't originate. What happens is that in this ground, there is this flashing out all the time. It's very discontinuous. In other words, it's just constantly flashing out. Stuff comes up. But it doesn't stay. It's like flashing and then it disappears. So if we've watched our thoughts, if we can actually see, we can do this in our own experiments with our practice by looking at where our thoughts arise from. We can't find where they arise from. We see they arise and they don't dwell anywhere. And then when we look for where they went, they disappear. They've gone again. And that's precisely what is happening in this ground. Is that everything is just continuously, Michael brought up last week, we discussed how in a single moment, or what we call an instant, is, various people have decided, just offered the possibility of saying, well, if you could divide a second up into 300s, then that might be an instant. So, you know, but in any case, hundreds of times in what we would call a given second, which is actually, second is just the measurements we impose on something that is beyond thought. We're trying to make sense by creating time, by developing these little configurations and measuring, and in that process, we decide that's real. So here's the deal. It's not real. It's our invention. This is the big story. Because it actually is all about ego.
Michael?
Yeah.
You sort of hopped over the seventh. Maybe you could go back to that.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Well, so we were at the seventh consciousness. I had to explain. I can't talk about the seventh without discussing the eighth, at least essentially. So the seventh is like this wind, which is kind of stirring the waters of the eighth consciousness. This is almost like Genesis, you know. It pulls stuff out of the eighth, which actually it doesn't understand. Because the seventh consciousness is called oftentimes the afflicted consciousness, because it's fundamentally confused. And various schools of Buddhism, some say, we just want to get rid of that. You know, just nothing but a nuisance that's in the way.
It's your neurotic, basically neurotic upheavals, or kleshas, which we use that word.
It's called kleshaman.
Kleshaland.
Kleshaland. Yeah, so kleshaland, because it's afflicted. That's the meaning of klesha, is fundamental affliction. We talked about klesha as disturbed emotions, but it's fundamental affliction. So
it's what always stirs up the story about me.
Yeah, and the story of me is that there's this blip that keeps on coming up all the time. And, you know, and then it disappears in the instant it arises. And then there's a blip, and then there's a blip, and what happens is there is this process of, which I don't want to use the word yet, but I have to in some sense, karmic stream or stream of mind that is nervous about this because it wants to develop a sense of continuity, because it wants to make sense out of the whole thing. We all want to make sense out of things, right? This is everybody wants some kind of sense. Animals, it's a little simpler. Humans get much more complex in terms of what, because they often want, now we want a storyline. Now the minute we want a storyline, but the reason why we want a storyline is because this is basically the source of a very subtle kind of anxiety. And if you remember, we talked about anxiety as being the basis for what gives rise ultimately to hope and fear and all of the complications which we then call suffering. Yes?
Is the eighth consciousness alya as in our baggage, or is the eighth consciousness the deeper alya?
So I have to introduce a term.
Region.
Yeah, I will introduce a term. Get your pencil ready and go.
So
we have, but we have the first, the eighth consciousness is alaya, is spelled A-L-A-Y-A, like the Himalayas. And then the second word for this eighth consciousness is alaya vijnana, which means it's bifurcated, it's split, it's dualistic. Because it's all about this and that, me and you, me and them. And this that business is really the issue of where there's confusion. So V-I-G-N-A-N-A, vijnana. And that means split consciousness or split awareness.
So it's not...
Yeah, I'm sorry, V-I-J, what did I say?
G.
I'm sorry. V-I-G-N-A-N-A.
No, not G.
Huh?
V-I-J.
V-I-J-N-A-N-A.
Sorry.
I'm confused.
V-I-J.
It's all pervasive. It's confused. V-I-J.
N-A-N-A.
N-A-N-A. And we call it vijnana. And that we distinguish that from the greater alaya, which is called alaya jnana. And that's spelled alaya, and then a second word, J-N-A-N-A. And actually that word jnana is what we call a cognate. It's a root form in Sanskrit. We have the word gnosis. We have the word know, K-N-O-W. It actually comes from that. It's a cognate from that root term way back when.
This is not the wonderful deeper alaya of primordial ground. That's something else.
No, the primordial ground is the alaya jnana.
Wisdom.
One. Yeah.
Wisdom.
It's wisdom.
So
it's
the eighth consciousness?
Yes. No,
so
no. The VI in front of it means it's basically forked, it's created a divorce or a little boundary between the fundamental totality and something else that wants to hold itself to itself as an identity.
But aren't they both in the eighth consciousness?
No.
No. You can go into the eighth consciousness, and you can access the greater consciousness in the process of working with it. Yes, yes.
Okay, and the primordial ground consciousness is called
alaya.
A L
A Y A.
A L A Y A.
And then jnana, J N A N A. Just remember all the difference in the world with that little V. That's the split. Yeah. So there's alaya vijnana, eighth consciousness, and there's alaya jnana, primordial ground.
Why are they both called alaya?
Foundation.
Why?
Well, in the case of the eighth consciousness, it's because it refers to one's personal foundations or the basic space which people use for creating self-reference. It consists of memories, thoughts, prejudices.
But it seems like they're opposites. They're alaya, but you're giving two definitions that are just total opposite.
Well, I know, but I'm using a term that if we pursue this or you decide to explore this further on your own, this is the word they use. But remember, vijnana is the difference.
Yeah.
Vijnana, V-I-J-N-A-N-A. That's the personal eighth. The jnana is just
the split.
Yeah, when we said rest in the nature of alaya, we did not make that distinction.
We don't mean that one.
Vijnana. But you say rest in the nature of alaya, that is the jnana, the wisdom one.
Well, it isn't introduced in the Hinayana.
Well, you're going to make three terms. You don't want to do that, do you?
Sorry?
Then you're going to have three terms. You don't want that, do you?
Well, Okay, so I think the important thing right now is to understand we have this eighth consciousness. Just remember number eight. And remember number seven is this little mosquito that goes in there and pulls everything out and constantly buzzes around and makes problems. Because it basically decides what, how to be a pain, how to create problems, what, something to complain about, something to feel bad about, something to identify with, and we constantly have to find new things to identify with because the situation keeps on shifting and changing. It's not like we have this solid entity. So our mind still says, we do, because it wants continuity. But if we would use this term self, for instance, to describe me or ego, then we begin to, as we explore our meditation practice, we begin to realize which self? Who's talking now? Who's thinking now? Just look at where your thoughts come from and what are they saying? Is there any consistency? You know, even if you try to find, there are certain storylines that certainly work at being consistent, but then there's a whole other storylines that are totally contradictory, operating on completely different principles, whatever. I mean, just the facets that we have to cope with. And so this is in a constant state of invention. And that's the important thing. We're not dealing with anything that's permanent. And so that's the important, that's where the good news is. This is all impermanent. Now, if we actually had to deal with this stuff as permanent, it would be really heavy work.
But we call it form. So how does that fit together? Form seems like it's a, you know, maybe that's a different definition where there's more solidity. But what we're talking about now is consciousness. How does that?
Well, no, we are talking fundamentally about naming, about labeling, about grasping, about fundamentally trying to nail something down. And we call that form. And so, you know, then we could go back to the more traditional description of form. Well, what is it? Well, it's what I see. And what do I see? It's what I see now. And
so the problem is our grasping for form.
Essentially, yes. Where the problem is ultimately fixation. We call fixation and grasping those two things together. Fixation, because we fixate and want to hold something together. We don't want to let go of it. Grasping is, you know, like just constantly ensuring that we'll stay there. Yes.
Right. So it seems to me that it's not necessarily form is the problem. It's that we want the form to stay the same instead of changing. And so we take that moment that it exists right there, and then we forecast and say, that's what it is right there. But by the time we've said, that's what it is, it's not that anymore.
That's right. And we want to understand, too. I will say this now because we're going to be studying Skandhas for the next 5 weeks or so.
Please do come back. I'll make it simpler.
Well, next week it's feeling. It's going to be a lot simpler. It will, because you only have to coast on. You're going to be basically pushing out a form into feeling. So it's not so complex at all.
You found Skandhas for
dummies. But Skandhas is going to make comments next week, I'm sure.
So as we go on, if different teachings, we talk about Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, have different ways of dealing with this issue of the Skandhas altogether. And in the Hinayana, it's viewed as we need to basically see what's going on and release. And in Hinayana, we see the problem as fundamentally being attachment. So the whole question of practice and the fruition of that practice is non-attachment. And it's freedom from grasping and fixation. So and that's actually a pretty interesting ground level. It's very good. You know, I mean, as Conda Rinpoche talked about when she was here a couple of months ago, she said one of the characteristics of someone who is actually a good Hinayana practitioner is simplicity, silence, and non-thought. Meaning you're not being buzzed, you don't have thoughts buzzing in your head all the time driving you crazy. You keep a very simple and are very content with a simple life, and you are harmless. So we would say
who knows any of those things.
We could say, well, that, yeah, right. We're not hitting on it. I mean, for better or worse, that's the situation. But they view that as the fundamental path and fruition. The fruition fundamentally is resting in what they call things as they are. So you could say sitting, doing a meditation practice for an hour, and you know, in that time, your mind never wavers. That would be considered top dog meditator. No thinking, all thoughts. If they are, they just like might there might be little quirks appearing on the radar screen. They disappear instantly. And there's total imperturbability and relaxation and peace. So, you know, you could say that that would be how they work that. Now, in the case of where we're coming from, I want to also mention the... well, the reason why we go on from there is because people don't get it. You know, I mean, if it were that simple, we would have all gotten this a long time ago. But because we didn't, we had to then create the Mahayana, which would then give us a much bigger perspective of how to work with all this. And the Mahayana views everything fundamentally in terms of basically transforming everything to make something good out of it. You have something fundamentally problematic, well then, let's turn that into medicine. Let's find a way we can extract some elements in the confusion that actually can be used to treat and finally release the patient from the problem. And that's all sentient beings. We view that in Mahayana as not only for ourselves alone, but certainly because it's all based on a larger reality of working toward the liberation of all beings. And so that kind of medicine would be applied universally, or at least extensively. And then we have the Vajrayana. So now, we're getting a little flavor of Vajrayana here. because what this, and you're going to encounter that in here, which is very important. It's a lovely way to sort of get brushed with Vajrayana. And here we talk about transforming the eight sense consciousnesses into wisdom. In other words, it says that intrinsically these things are wisdom to begin with. That in terms of ultimate reality, everything is fundamental wisdom. We don't see it because we're confused. We've coated it over with all of our skandhas and our stuff. And so as we go through our practices, we liberate those things, or we discover the natural liberated nature in each of those factors. And when that happens, and those things suddenly are somehow revealed to be what they really are, we discover that these skandhas actually are what we call the five wisdoms. So we will be discussing the five wisdoms as we go forward. But that, what that means is, and this is very important, is not only is everything only happening now, but we're never going to go anywhere other than where we are now in terms of what we have. It's all here. All of the possibilities of Buddhahood is here and now. We do not have to go and get a different suit of clothes on and go off and get on the train and go to some other country or something. We're actually getting, wherever we are right now, this is it, and it always has been and always will be. This is the whole point of how this is ultimate. So we're getting, this is, and because it is so intimate on this level, because that does mean intimate. I mean, you know, this is what Christians would like to, if you know, when they talk about God and intimacy, they're talking about some kind of ultimate reality that's fundamentally the most intimate possibility that people can experience. Well, we don't have God, as we know. But, you know, it's absolutely what it's about. It's about just fundamental reality. And so reality is something that you begin to realize is the most interesting thing you could possibly ever know. And it's very good news. Do we have any questions at this point? Please.
Could I go back to something I didn't say last week?
Yeah.
The question came up, and I think it was from Linda, of why we insist on the development of ego as being in the present as opposed to a historical view like childhood and so on? That was the question, was it not?
Yeah, I was just trying to get it. I think of the term as being in the historical.
Yeah.
I just wondered why development was used even then, if that's not what it's meant.
Okay, so, and we said it's always in the present, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so when you're going to go into the past, you have to do it by memory, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, indeed, any kind of work we're doing here is going to go into the past in the sense that you're talking about, but it's going to do it through memory. When is the memory happening?
It's always.
No, what? Yeah, in other words, the memory is in the present. And as we start to understand our mind more, we see that we don't have any memory of some objective thing that happened in the past. Our mind just doesn't have that capacity. What we remember, in particular what we can remember that can be verbalized, is the dualistic take we took on it. In other words, what we remember is the story we told ourselves.
The story. Yeah. Right.
Okay? And you can only do that once.
Yeah.
Because if you remember it the second time, now you're remembering the story you told yourself about how you remember.
Yeah.
So that's why it's in the present. It doesn't mean that we're obliterating anything about the past.
Right.
It's just that our mind can only deal with our present memory of the past, and that's a suspicious thing, at least, and we're going to see how suspicious it is as we try to develop some sense of exercise.
So what we're talking about here is basically this skanda is what starts the sequence of all these other ones, and what the skandhas do is they basically shield ourselves from this naked truth, which is fundamentally it just beyond understanding. But it doesn't mean we can't work with it. It's fundamentally beyond grasp of mind. So the meditation practice that we do, as we develop the shamatha vipassana, and we start to see through the skandhas, they start to become transparent. We can actually start to penetrate and see how they work. We see how they repeat themselves endlessly over and over in our experience. We can go beyond that. And then at that point, what actually happens with the first skandha is those quirks, those little disturbances that are going on continuously, can become an inspiration instead of something to try to shield or cover over or dress up and try to like make it something that it's not. Because when we make up to something that it is not, we are creating projections. And then we start to create these projections and put them out of ourselves onto others and the world. And then we expect the projections to reaffirm the person or the projector. Sometimes it's been said thoughts create the thinker, because we have the thinking, and then the thinking occurs, and therefore we infer that because there's thinking, there must be somebody who's thinking it, instead of just thinking. So when we do the meditation practice and we label thinking, we're not saying I'm thinking. We're just labeled thinking. It's just thinking without a maker, without an identity, an identifier, somebody to identify with.
This is a key point. So this is really important to remember.
So we're turning the cart upside down, because he said, I think, therefore, I am.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
We don't go along with that.
I am not, so therefore I don't think.
No.
On Sunday, Alan Tupton said, when you're attached to your identity, you miss the opportunity to know who you really are.
That's right.
Right.
And that, he said, your mind or your head has a lot of ideas about who you are.
Now, one interesting thing about this, these skandhas also, in form itself, these little blips on the screen that come up continuously flashing out, they are beyond cause and effect. They have no cause and effect. It's totally spontaneous. I can refer you to the Shurangama Sutra, which was an early sutra. S-U-R-A-N-G-A-M-A. And it says, form has neither cause nor happens. It's just basically, it doesn't happen because something makes it happen. It's just spontaneous. So this is a very interesting kind of insight. And when this starts to seep through our experience and we stabilize, you know, this is when we actually can really understand what the nature of reality. And we can actually experience peace because we don't have any argument with this situation. Yes,
So, I'm fascinated by this idea that there's no, that these arising and following you are not caused, right?
Say, come again?
So, the thing you said a moment ago about how these things that arise aren't caused.
Yeah.
And so does that mean, but they take, I'm seeing a distinction here, they take a form.
Yeah.
The problem is that we see that form and freeze it in that form, right? It's actually going, it goes on moving, we stick it in a category.
Well, we also separate from it. And this
yes.
is, yeah, okay. That's the issue. And when we do that, and Rinpoche talked about how really the answer to this is simply identifying totally with the form. Identify totally with your senses. Don't have any separation between you and sound, smell, taste, or touch. You're just being there. Yes, sir.
I mean, relatedly, I think you used the term objective reality before. But objective reality, I thought I heard you a while ago say that. But this idea of spontaneity suggests there is no objective reality at all.
Well, that was definitely a slip back
Maybe
into my old dualistic thinking system. Sorry. Yes, we don't. I mean, there's no subjective and objective here. We're talking about, you know, the singularity.
So it's not caused.
It's not caused.
But it's not random either.
I don't know. I mean, did you? Are you sure of that? I'm not sure about. I'm not sure about that. I mean, when we go into, for instance, subatomic particles and chaos theory, we could say, you know, we're looking at a lot of what seems like randomness. It depends on where the perspective is. At one time, physicists were just saying this is all random motion. You know, and then as chaos theory began to develop and we got clearer about how a lot of these seemingly random events occur, we begin to see there's some kind of order to it. Yes?
My very limited understanding of some astrophysics, the question came up on what caused the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. And one of the theories is that there is no cause.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting on how much of what you're saying seems to align with what a lot of modern day physicists and astrophysicists are saying
mm-hmm.
about how things work on a very large scale or even on a very small scale. They're trying to let go of that idea of cause and effect, of something causing something else,
mm-hmm.
to open up to bigger ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really interesting that if they could go back 2,500 years, they might find some more answers.
We asked, if we're going to ask what caused the Big Bang, then that means what caused the Big Bang to happen at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is there was no time.
No time at that point.
So therefore, the question is framed in a nonsensical reference from the view of emptiness.
Yeah.
So you're right, yeah.
But, you know, from our point of view, We're not dealing with theoretical physics now. We are dealing with here and now. We're dealing with, it's ultimately pragmatic. This is why Buddhism is important, because it works because it's just dealing with what we actually can work with. It's not dealing with hypothetical possibilities. It doesn't do
Roberta
that.
Has a question.
Roberta, yeah.
And I thought we sort of believed in cause and effect. And we talked about that before. And I thought, like...
You're talking about karma?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we talk about, we're trying to understand what the basis of karma is. Karma is going to come up now because we actually create the mechanisms of karma. And we're going to be discussing that. We're going to touch on it briefly in this course when we, because I've just introduced something called the eight consciousnesses. And now we have one more little thing I'm going to mention, but we're not going to go into details, called the Nidanas. 12 Nidanas. You asked, I'm telling you. 12 Nidana. It's in the book. And that 12 Nidanas describe how karma works, how the whole process of cause and effect work in the context of confused mind.
Yeah. Actually, that's more comfortable, I think, with the Nidanas than on the outside and the addicted and the... hell realm and the
yeah,
that somehow makes more sense to me than like this has I'm just confused on we do believe in cause and effect when it relates to karma, but with whatever we're talking about now, which I'm not sure what it is, there is no cause and effect. And
there is no ultimate cause and effect because we're talking about the primordial ground. But once we get away from that, once we go on the second, third, fourth, and fifth skandhas, we are getting into the gate, the very familiar business of how the mechanism of cause and effect. What are the mechanics of this ego that we create? What are the elements? What are the nuts and bolts?
When we talk about, when we're talking about blips that occur,
yeah,
are we talking about like the blips in our mind? Or the blips, like thoughts.
Yeah.
Are blips.
Could be. Could be.
But what is this flash you mentioned out of the ground?
Some of those, they seem like, if it's, of course, me who doesn't exist, those blips have some relation to something. I mean, there is a cause for the blip.
No, but there's no, we're talking about something more profound.
We're not talking about that kind of
thing. Yeah, I mean, this is why we've moved into... I don't know if I finished discussing the Mahamudra thing. But basically, we're going into understanding how everything is the expression of Buddha nature. I mean, that's finally what this is about. And these blips, or these little flashes that occur out of the ground, are fundamental expressions of wisdom. We don't see them that way, because we're not trained, we are fundamentally just confused and bewildered. And the word bewilderment is very important here, because we're asking always for a reference point. This is our habit of mind. We want reference points. This is beyond reference points.
Can you give an example of these blips?
Why not? No one's telling you what to believe, first of all.
Your questions
you're good.
Are right on.
You're good.
What
you're good.
So
what's a blip?
What is it? Is it purple? Is it a form? Does it have a form? Do I think it is?
It could be purple. It could be a sore thumb. It could be someone shining a light at you. It could be an insult, or what you take to be an insult. It could be anything that
occurred. Okay, those seem like the blips that have to do with karma.
Actually, the blips are far beyond that. If we study the Bardo teachings, which are the intermediate states. There's a bardo of this life, and then there's a bardo of immediate of dying, and then there's a bardo of that first moment of death, and that point of where the death and the first bardo occurs. That's where we encounter the dimension of the alaya, that it just flashes in front of us for a moment. And what's described at is just primordial energy that is absolutely pure, and it's completely blinding in the sense that it's very, very intimidating. And I mean, I'm speaking now from a human point of view. And so what we do is we try to hide from it because we don't know how to cope with that. But it's actually our own nature. And so the teachings are tell us that basically what we're doing is training in our practice and path so that we can cope with this primordial ground. We can cope with the energies that flash out in this primordial ground at death, and we
all,
can actually...
All the time.
All the time.
Okay, our mind is producing so much brilliance that at every instant we're hiding from it. I think that's...
Yeah, that's it.
Constantly.
Yeah.
It's instantaneously looking for a reference point. To solidify.
How do we reduce what's happening to what we think we can manage? That's the whole Skanda thing.
Yeah.
So it's from that space, this energy is arising. You could think of it as energy.
It's pure energy.
It's just arising, this energy.
Coming out of the primordial.
That's right.
And it's there, and it's always happening. But as everyone's saying, you know, we don't, we shut down against that. So what we're showing here is this development, and what's being described today is the beginning of that process of development of ego, and how we take that arising and then we start to solidify it, and then we build on that and we build on that. So like you have to figure it out today either. That's another thing. So just be open to let whatever's coming through happen.
This is introduction. I mean, again, just...
Wait, we've got several people wanting to ask questions.
Go ahead. Based on what you're saying, the primordial ground, could that be seen as the whole?
Yes.
In fact, and what's being referred as karma, as the impure, the parts of that, which is a distortion, the attempt to fix that whole...
Or fragments of it.
Because that, a legitimate way to understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least you still have a book.
Yeah, so I was trying to think like form, bring it sort of like down. Like at work, there's these windows that look out over the hills of Newton, and I just stop and I look out and I see what's there. So if I look and I just see and whatever's there is interesting, is that not form? Or if I look out and I'm like, oh, I hope the leaves are these colors and I want that tree to be a different color.
Now you're throwing something else in there. If you're just beholding it and seeing it for what it is, you enjoying it, why not? I mean, that's great.
But the mind just goes like tree, leaf, bird,
so
sky.
The
is it going to rain? Oh, no, did I bring my coat? Oh, you know, and you're off.
Am I enjoying it?
who can I tell about this beautiful thing that I just saw? So the mind just takes off from there in a shot.
Yeah.
And but the moment, the whole universe.
The moment that I look and I'm like, this is really interesting.
Well, then this is really interesting because...
Or whatever. This is, you know, I like looking at this. So even that is form?
Yeah, it's underneath that. So that's beyond what we're talking about here. This is much more primordial than that.
And as been described by people who... People had to experience this to be able to discuss this. This isn't somebody's invention. Is that these primordial flashes are very intimidating, and we are also frightened about them. I mean, this is... So when we talk about bardo, you know, and you read about what goes on in the bardos, about people trying to, like, go down a rabbit hole because they just want to escape the kind of energy coming at them, that energy that's coming at them, it's our own nature. And so that's the fundamental important thing about this ground. If the ground is not something out there...
Why are we scared of it? Why are we scared of it? You said we fear it. Why are we
because
scared?
We're afraid of ourselves.
But why?
Because we can't. Because we why?
Because we solidify our ego. That's our protective mechanism,
and it feels threatened by it.
Right.
Yeah. I'd rather have that. I mean, I'd rather experience that. So you're saying the ego hinders you from seeing
that? The ego wants to be comfortable. This is not necessarily comfortable. Because these things occur, it doesn't necessarily mean it's all pleasant. You know, it's beyond pleasant, but, you know, when we start to look for the byproducts of experience and attach ourselves to those, which is basically pleasure and pain. We can get very associate pleasure with some kind of reward and pain with some kind of punishment. And so, you know, when we experience something that comes at us out of nowhere, you know, our first possible recourse would be to set up some kind of a defense, or at least I want to, like, get behind the wall here so I can get some kind of better perspective on what's happening rather than just be on the middle of the field getting potentially blasted. It's like, you know, a creature from outer space coming in with a,
right.
like a...
Right, that's actually right along the line of what I was thinking. So if I was looking out that window at that scenery and a pterodactyl suddenly flew by, if I get surprised by that, that's ego. If I can just see that,
fire the dragon, we're saying that.
Now, so we all want to understand what we all want to understand this, and all of us here are grasping. And since we aren't really going to understand this now, we have to at least notice that we're all trying to grasp at an understanding. I think all of us,
sure. Roberta.
How clear is this in the book?
I think the important thing is just to read the book with an open mind.
Okay.
And bring your questions in. I mean, this is not something we expect that to next week we're just going to jump into the next skanda and let's forget about what we talked. No.
Okay.
You need to bring all of your questions and concerns and whatever, you know, you want to explore and clarify next week. That's very important. This is if we don't understand in general, at least get the general drift of the first principle, because this is like called the first principle. If we don't understand this, we're not going to really be clear about the other skandhas. We won't understand. We can memorize them and say, gee, that's a nice psychological system of psychology, but we're really trying to talk about something else that's much more fundamental. So at this point, I think the best thing I could suggest is just to be open, mm-hmm. and just experience it. Read it the first time as if you're reading a newspaper, and don't worry about, you know, answering questions or anything else. Go back, read
you're
it again.
Out.
It's a short chapter, so it bears rereading a couple of times without feeling like a major project here or something.
And know that being confused is part of the path. So you're not. It's not that. It's not the way you go to school. That's not what we're teaching. It's not here's a list, memorize this, and then you tell us back what it is. This is a process of stripping away all these layers. It's more like peeling paint. You know, if you got layers and layers on an old house, you have to peel away those layers of paint to get to the original wood. So it takes time because there's also resistance that arises from ego. So there's a barrier that'll come up when you start to get close to the electric wire. There's a natural reaction to that. So that's why it's a process, and you have to be very generous and relaxed with the whole thing, but stay open and don't give up.
And we're here to help in any way we can. I mean, even if we're going to confess that we haven't had this, we can't say we've completely got this thing nailed down. We're exploring it together. I mean, I think that's part of it. We're sharing our own path with you, and inviting you to explore this with us and see how this can work. But I can tell you that people who have given these teachings have been able to resolve that issue for themselves, and they didn't do it by just, you know, falling asleep on it. They actually leaned into it and spent a lot of time and came to this understanding, and they wouldn't have taught it to other people without feeling like they had the capacity to at least share some understanding in that process. And that's why these things are alive today. We're talking not about some kind of an ancient old system of trying to understand psychology. We're talking about something vividly present in us right now.
Okay, thank you.